Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998. How to Improve Our Souls.
Hello. Perhaps you won't mind if today I just share a few thoughts with you about where our people are now and where we're headed, instead of doing my usual news analysis. One of the things I've complained about often is that when so many terribly destructive things are happening to us, most of our people are simply remaining as spectators, refusing to lift a hand against the enemies who certainly will destroy us if we permit them. We have Bill Clinton in the White House, the clearest proof there could be that the present political system in America, the system by which we choose our legislators and our governmental executives, has gone completely haywire. We simply cannot have people like Bill Clinton as president and the gang of criminals in the Congress making our laws and expect America to survive. Hundreds of thousands of responsible men and women should rise up in righteous wrath against Washington and its system, but they don't. Or consider immigration. It is destroying America. Much of California and Florida have been transformed from white to non-white areas during the past couple of decades, and the same thing is happening in many other parts of the country. Areas which used to be clean, decent, and white have become third-world jungles. Millions of people realize what is happening, but very few are willing to do anything about it, except move to a whiter suburb. Most white Americans are even afraid to say anything about the darkening of America from fear of being denounced as racists by the loudmouthed, bullying forces of political correctness. The Clinton government realizes that most of the people who don't like what is happening to America are suffering from moral paralysis at this time and will not rebel, no matter what the government does. And so the government keeps our borders open, knowing that every non-white immigrant is another supporter of the Clinton system and to hell with the country. The schools are another indicator of America's illness. I've spoken on other programs about specific aspects of the school problem. A lack of order and discipline, lower standards, falling performance. The schools have become so bad that even the government is worried about them. But of course, no one can fix them because no one is willing to address the real problems behind the failure of the schools. The feminists and the egalitarians and the multiculturalists are instantly ready, with the support of the controlled media, to attack anyone who questions what they and their doctrines have done to the schools. And so the great social experiment in the schools goes on, with the pioneers of the New World Order laboring to condition the next generation of young Americans to be happy consumers in a more diverse and egalitarian society. And if occasionally the brainwashing doesn't take, and the kiddies become alienated to the point that one or two of them decide to blow away a dozen or so of their classmates and teachers, why then clearly what's needed is even more diversity and more metal detectors at the schoolhouse doors. The clearest indicator that we have a very serious problem is in our people themselves. The young boys who wear backward baseball caps and baggy shorts and ape black speech and manners because they've been watching MTV and believe that it's cool to dress and behave like blacks. Then there are the college girls who slavishly follow every fashion in attire and grooming, no matter how ugly or silly, and every fashion in ideas, no matter how foolish or destructive. What's cool or fashionable or smart for our young people is whatever the Jews of Hollywood or Madison Avenue dream up and present to them in a slick and glitzy package. All too often, the Jews who are corrupting our young people have the eager assistance of fools or traitors from among those of us old enough to know better, and not just the politicians. Bill Gates's Microsoft Corporation buys full-page magazine advertisements promoting racial mixing. Bill Gates has enough money that he doesn't have to do that to please the Jews. Perhaps the most disgusting example of this sort that I have encountered recently is a new Hollywood film called Bullworth. It's produced, directed, and acted in by actor Warren Beatty. Beatty always has been a limousine liberal who fancies himself a philosopher and a revolutionary as well as an actor. He likes to play far-left roles, both in films and in real life. Back when the Black Panthers were chic, Beatty was one of their patrons. He's sort of a male Jane Fonda. There's nothing Jewish about him, except the ideas and causes he promotes. In Bullworth, he plays a suicidal politician with a few loose screws who finds salvation in racial mixing. Beatty is the type of idiot who professes the belief that blacks are somehow more honest and authentic and noble than whites, and that blacks have a lot to offer white society. He thinks that a mass rape of white women by blacks might be a good way to improve our society and at the same time solve the race problem, so long as he can watch from his limousine and offer philosophical observations. People like Beatty wouldn't be dangerous, of course, if the Jewish media didn't encourage them and provide them with a way to infect impressionable young whites with their sick notions. It is a fact, of course, that the majority of our young people take their cues from the Jewish media, if not from Sumner Redstone's MTV or Steven Spielberg's propaganda films, then from a television comedy series or slick magazine advertising or a politically correct comic book, or from a piece of filth like Warren Beatty's Bullworth. What we see around us today are the consequences of the ideas, the policies, the attitudes, and the fashions pushed by the Jews in the media for the past 60 years or so. They began very cautiously, gradually trying to make interracial sex seem trendy and smart, just as they began very carefully promoting the acceptance of homosexuality and trying to make feminism seem normal and reasonable. But today they are 1,000 times more blatant than they were just 20 years ago. There is hardly a film coming from Hollywood today, or a television series, or an advertising campaign in a slick magazine, which doesn't promote one aspect or another of the Jewish agenda on race or sex. So perhaps in this pervasive influence of the Jewish media, we can see the reason for the passivity of our people in the face of their imminent destruction. The Jewish poison paralyzes the will before it kills the body. And if that is so, is not our situation hopeless? Well, you know what the Jews are doing in America. They also are doing elsewhere, in Britain and in France and in Germany and in Russia and in a dozen other countries. Now, the situation is a little different in each of these other countries, but in most places, the Jewish program is about as far along as it is in the United States, and in some countries, it is farther along. In Britain and France and Germany, one sees exactly the same race-mixing propaganda and the same demand that nothing be done to slow non-white immigration and the same effort to make homosexuality acceptable that one sees in the United States. But in these other countries, the Jews have succeeded in outlawing their opposition. Anyone who identifies the poison as Jewish can be thrown into prison. So in France and in Germany, they have MTV, as well as their local equivalents of MTV. And they have their own idiots of the Warren Beatty variety helping the Jews push their poison. And it is a penal offense, a hate crime, for a Frenchman or a German to say in public, hey, this Jewish propaganda is poisoning our people. So one might be even more inclined to think the situation hopeless in Europe. Nevertheless, the people in some countries are not quite as passive as in the United States. And if we pay attention to what is happening in Europe, we may be more inclined to be optimistic about America's future. At the beginning of this decade, the communist regimes of Eastern Europe, having bled dry the countries they had ruled with a bloody fist and an iron heel since the end of the Second World War, or in the case of Russia, since the end of the First World War, quietly folded their tents. Actually, what the communist bosses did in most cases was switch hats, declare themselves Democrats henceforth instead of communists, and continue hanging on to as much of their power and their ill-gotten plunder as they could. And for a while, it looked as if they would get clean away with this swindle. There were no mass lynchings of the former commissars. There were no mass arrests, trials, and executions of those who had collaborated with the communist regimes. There was no campaign to hunt down and punish the criminals who were responsible for the murder of millions of anti-communist Russians and Ukrainians and Poles and Hungarians and Germans and Balts and Bulgarians and others during the time of communist rule. Even a blood-drenched monster like Lazar Kaganovich, Stalin's brother-in-law, the Jewish butcher of Ukraine, was permitted to die quietly in his Moscow apartment. This was at a time when the Jews and their bought politicians in the West were keeping public interest in their 45-year-old Holocaust sideshow alive by continuing to find and put on trial elderly Germans who were accused of having mistreated God's chosen people during the Second World War. In the West, the Jewish motto was, never forget and never forgive. And they used all of their media resources to persuade the world that they had suffered more than anyone else during the Second World War, and that the people who had made them suffer still needed to be hunted down and punished. But in the East, where they had ruled, their motto was, let bygones be bygones. Of course, the Jews had made it illegal to accuse them for their crimes, or even to defend too vigorously those whom they accused, which could be interpreted as minimizing the Holocaust, a criminal offense in places like France and Germany. And they had had a long time to kill off most of their potential accusers anyway. These lay in mass graves all across Eastern Europe, from Eastern Germany to the Urals. But the biggest reason for the non-revolutionary and in some cases almost imperceptible transition between communism and democracy in Eastern Europe, and the failure of the people to undertake a thorough cleansing of their governments and other facets of public life in their countries, is that the people of Eastern Europe are still becoming accustomed to not having the Jews' heel on their necks, and they haven't been able to organize themselves well enough to seize control of their own news and entertainment media yet. They are still governed by former collaborators of the Jews, now wearing democratic hats. Russia's vodka-besotted Boris Yeltsin is a perfect example of this. A Slavic version of Bill Clinton, Yeltsin pals around with Russia's Jewish crime bosses, appoints Jews to top positions in the Russian government, and enjoys the support of the Jewish media. But things are beginning to show promise of real change. There is an emerging nationalism all across Eastern Europe, and the Jews and their allies seem unable to stamp it out. In Russia, for example, the struggle between Russian nationalism on the one hand and Jewish cosmopolitanism and materialism on the other hand manifests itself at several levels. But the most noticeable level, the level which has attracted the most media attention recently, is the struggle on the streets between young Russians influenced by the two tendencies. In Moscow, St. Petersburg, and the other major cities of Russia, young Russians influenced by the Jewish spirit are loosely organized into gangs of so-called rappers. They wear the same backward baseball caps and baggy pants seen among white MTV fans in America. They idolize black street thugs, black film stars, and black sports figures. Many of them are the children of former Communist Party bureaucrats and other Russians who were relatively well off under communism. Drug addiction is very common among rappers. Opposing the rappers are the young nationalists, many of whom are skinheads. The nationalists abhor Jews and any other non-white presence in Russia. They have contempt for drug users, and they enjoy beating up rappers and non-whites that they encounter on the streets or in shopping malls or cafes. In early May, they provoked a bit of an international incident when they beat up a black Marine guard from the U.S. Embassy. Today, only a minority of young Russians are active nationalists, and only a minority of those can correctly be called neo-Nazis, despite the Jews' tendency to apply that label to all of them. Their numbers are growing rapidly, however, and 2 weeks ago, the bombing of a Moscow synagogue provided a public signal that they know who the principal enemies of the Russian people are. In Germany, one sees a similar opposition between young people under the influence of the Jews on the one hand and young nationalists on the other hand. The anti-nationalist element in Germany is a bit more diverse than in Russia and tends toward the punk style in music, dress, and grooming rather than the rapper style. But this element draws its inspiration from the same source as the rappers, although in Germany it is illegal to identify that source as Jewish. The German punks, like the Russian rappers, are heavily into drugs and MTV, and both groups have been taught contempt and hatred for their own people. The German punk element is augmented by Turks and other non-white immigrants, by homosexuals and feminists, and by some young middle-class Germans in the western part of the country who, though not sporting the spiked, dyed hair and slovenly dress of the punks and not sharing their drug habit, do have a similar hatred for their own people, the product of two generations of anti-German brainwashing imposed by the conquerors of the Second World War. German nationalists also are a fairly diverse lot. The German People's Union, whose unexpected victory in the provincial elections in Saxony-Anhalt in April has greatly alarmed the ruling German establishment, consists mostly of older people who are predominantly conservative as well as nationalist. A younger and more vigorous nationalist group, the National Democratic Party of Germany, has members who are much more radical. Some of the younger members also are skinheads. Until about a year ago, the German anti-nationalists liked to organize their punks to break up nationalist meetings and throw rocks and bottles at nationalist marchers because they outnumbered the nationalists. This year, however, trying to break up nationalist meetings and marchers is a lot less fun because the nationalists, for the first time, are able to gather substantially larger numbers of young Germans together than the anti-nationalists can. The growth of radical nationalist activism in Germany has been even more rapid than in Russia. Especially promising is the fact that there is much mutual sympathy between young Russian radical nationalists and young German radical nationalists. They both understand who their common enemy is, although the Germans are not permitted to say so in public. There are several reasons for the brighter prospect for patriots in Germany and Russia than in the United States. But the most important and immediate reason is economic. Unemployment currently is 13% in Germany. The economy is even worse in Russia, and there is a glaring contrast between the lifestyles of Russian workers and the ostentatious wealth of the Jewish organized crime bosses and entrepreneurs. There can be no doubt that low unemployment, economic stability, and a reasonably high standard of living make most of our people in America cautious about doing anything to rock the boat. People will tolerate almost anything, no matter how much they may disagree with it, no matter how repulsive they find it, if they can tolerate it in comfort. Generally, it requires discomfort or anxiety about the future to move people to do what they know they ought to do. The old saying that suffering is good for the soul really applies in this case. The German and Russian people have been paralyzed by the same Jewish poison which has paralyzed us. But the souls of the Germans and the Russians are being improved by their current economic situations. If they are lucky, their souls will continue to improve long enough for their patriots to wrest political control and media control away from the traitors and collaborators. And you know, that also could happen in America. Certainly, the awareness of our fundamental problems here is increasing. What we need now is a substantial increase in our discomfort level so that our souls can improve enough for us to recover from our moral paralysis and begin doing what we know we should do. Perhaps the Germans or the Russians will teach us how. Thanks for being with me again today.